Excuse me, this is the operator. I would like to inform all participants that this conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thanks very much. Okay, so welcome everyone to the March 2010 Charm Telecon. And let's see, our speaker today is Dr. Catherine Nisch, and Catherine is got her PhD with Jonathan Lunine at the University of Arizona. Jonathan Lunine is one of the Cassini Titan interdisciplinary scientists, and she's also worked with the radar team, Ralph Lorenz in particular, who's given at least one or two of these charm telecons using radar data. And she's going to give us a presentation today entitled Titan Ingredients for Life. And for those of you maybe listening to the podcast of this, please download the PowerPoint presentation for best viewing and following along with the speaker. And I'll remind everyone that star 6 mutes their phone, and it's a toggle, so you can toggle and come back on. But if you have any noise in the background, please mute your phone. And I think that's my list of things to say. So with that, I'll welcome Catherine. Go ahead.
Thanks, Marcia, and good afternoon / morning to everybody. I guess evening, maybe, for those in Europe. So today I'm going to talk to you about my favorite place in the solar system, which is Titan, and what that might tell us about the origin of life on our own world. So if you flip to the second slide, you'll see the view of Titan that we had prior to Cassini. This is an image taken by the Voyager spacecraft, which flew by Titan in the early 1980s. And what you see is basically a big orange blob. We didn't know much about Titan's surface prior to Cassini because Voyager didn't have the right instruments in order to view the surface. There's very little difference in the albedo of Titan. You can maybe see a slightly darker patch at the North Pole, which is a haze layer near the North Pole, but basically all you're seeing is an orange, grimy haze layer which shrouds all of Titan's surface. Now, if you move to the third slide, you'll see an image of Titan taken by the Cassini-VIMS instrument. And so we've gone from an orange blob to a whole new world, and actually a strangely Earth-like world for an icy satellite. It has lakes and streams, sand dunes, clouds, rain. In my opinion, Titan is the most Earth-like planet in the solar system, even though there is this huge temperature difference. And in fact, if you go to the next slide, my former advisor, Jonathan Lunine, likes to call Titan the once and future Earth after the Arthurian legend, the once and future king. You can see he's sort of modified the title of this book here to the left. So the idea is that Titan might represent Earth in the future when the sun proceeds in its lifetime, becomes hotter, proceeds towards red giant phase, the Earth is going to warm up, the oceans may evaporate, and what we may be left with is a world kind of like Titan, where the lakes are concentrated at the polar regions where it's cooler, but generally it's a desert planet. That's not the Titan I'm going to talk to you about today. The Titan I'm interested in is the once Earth, the prior Earth, the Earth before life, and what Titan might tell us about that history, that part of Earth's history. Titan has an atmosphere made of nitrogen and methane, and reactions that occur in this atmosphere create a wealth of very complicated organic molecules. That's that orange haze that you saw earlier. And so we might be able to learn something about chemistry, particularly prebiotic chemistry, from looking at Titan. If you'll go to the next slide, you'll see sort of a pictorial representation of the two major ideas behind how prebiotic molecules, biological molecules, might have arrived at the Earth. On the right is the exogenous delivery, so delivery from comets and meteorites. And so this sort of passes the buck a little bit, and says, well, these organics formed in space, and people are looking into how that happened, and then they were delivered to the Earth on a comet or on a meteorite. On the left is the type of chemistry I'm more interested in. That's endogenic production of organics. So production of organic molecules in a planet's atmosphere, on its surface, and its near subsurface. And so I think this is where Titan can tell us a lot about how biological molecules were formed and eventually turned into life on the Earth. So if we go to the next slide, the earliest experiments that were done in this area were done by Stanley Miller, who was actually a graduate student at the time, in 1953. And he did a very simple experiment that yielded some very interesting results. He took an atmosphere that at the time people thought might have represented the atmosphere of the early Earth, that of methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water. Today we think there was probably more oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere, but that is also an area of research. And he took these gases, and he included energy, and then he just waited a couple days and found that you could create some simple amino acids. Amino acids are the components of proteins, and proteins are sort of the workhorse of the human body and all life like ours. And so it seems that if you have the raw ingredients that you might find anywhere in the solar system or in the universe, simple molecules, energy, you can make the components of life. It seems actually relatively easy. So what can Titan tell us about this process? If you go to the next slide, it turns out that this experiment on Titan might be somewhat more difficult. So one thing that Titan doesn't have that the Earth seems to have a lot of is oxygen. And I'm not talking about O2, which we breathe, but rather O, the molecule oxygen. Most of Titan's atmosphere is made up of carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen, about 98% N2 and roughly 2% methane, CH4. There is some oxygen in Titan's atmosphere in the form of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and water, but it's present at very low levels. So if you have chemistry occurring in Titan's atmosphere, it's probably less likely that you get an oxygen into the molecules that you're creating. Here you can see the importance of oxygen. On the right is a picture of the amino acid glycine. The two gray blobs are carbon, the blue sphere is nitrogen, the white spheres are hydrogen, and the red spheres are oxygen. So here is the simplest amino acid, and you can see that two very important components of it are the oxygen atom. So how might we get oxygen into organics that are being formed in Titan's atmosphere? And so one way to do it might be to react these organics that are being formed in the atmosphere, made mostly of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, with water, water being H2O and having plenty of oxygen. And as you will see in the remainder of the talk, it's actually relatively easy to do this, to react these easy organic molecules with water. So if you go to the next slide, this is slide 8, if you know anything about Titan, you might think I'm crazy for talking about liquid water, since its surface temperature is 200 degrees, about 200 degrees below the freezing point of water. It's a big ice rock. But just like we don't expect to see rock flowing across the surface of the Earth, we do occasionally see that happen in the form of volcanoes. So if you've ever been to Hawaii, you might have seen molten rock on the Big Island flowing across the ground. And the same thing would be true for Titan. The rock there is ice, so any lava you might have would be water. In addition, if you have a comet impacting Titan, there'll be enough energy there to melt the surface and create water. These oases of water won't last very long, not as long as Titan's lifetime, 4.5 billion years, but there are these transient liquid water environments you might find on Titan where you could react the surface of the organics coming from the atmosphere with this water at relatively higher temperatures for Titan, anywhere between 176 Kelvin, which is the temperature of ammonia water mixture cooled to its lowest level. Ammonia provides antifreeze for water, all the way up to the freezing point of pure water, which is 0 degrees Celsius or 273 Kelvin. So if you go to the next slide, I'm going to outline sort of the idea I wanted to pursue is basically we have liquid water on Titan for short periods of time. We have the raw ingredients that you might need to form biological molecules. But are these reactions fast enough to produce those oxygen-containing prebiotic molecules you might need? And in addition, what might this tell us about the origins of life on the Earth and anywhere else in the universe, for that matter? And one particular hypothesis I'm going to call out is called the cold origin of life hypothesis. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see my excellent PowerPoint drawing, where you can kind of get a sort of a schematic of what the cold origin of life hypothesis is. So the idea is that in Earth's early history, the sun was a lot fainter. It also produced more UV light. And so the Earth might have been colder, and there might have been more ice. And that ice might, you might have pools of water covered in ice layers with prebiotic chemistry happening under that ice layer. And it would be protected by the UV light coming from the sun from any impacts. In addition, this ice layer, the slowly freezing pond, would end up concentrating any organic molecules trapped there, since the pure water tends to freeze out, leaving any contaminants behind. So this actually might be a decent place to have started life on Earth, not in Darwin's canonical warm pond, but actually in a cold, frozen pond. So if we go to the next slide, I'm going to outline sort of the questions that we have to look at to determine whether or not we can make biological molecules on Titan. So the first thing we need to figure out is how long we have for liquid water to be available on the surface. How long do we have before it freezes? And the reactions would presumably stop. Then we need to compare that to the reaction rates of these haze-like particles you might find on Titan with water at relevant temperatures. And finally, figure out what the nature or the structure of the resultant products are. Are they similar to biological molecules we find on Earth, or are they much different? Do they have different structures that wouldn't be necessarily very useful for biology? So those are the three questions I want to tackle today. And if you go to the next slide, I'm just going to set you up for that first question, which is how long it takes for these liquid water environments, these lavas and impact melts, to freeze before they freeze. So if you go to the next slide, slide 13, you'll see that Carl Sagan and his graduate student Reed Thompson were actually one of the first people to estimate this for Titan. They made a very simple assumption. They assumed the impact melt was a sphere of water underneath a crater, and then they could solve this equation to determine how long that sphere would last before it froze solid. And they estimated that for a 10-kilometer crater, you'd have 10,000 years before it would freeze, and for a 100-kilometer crater, you'd have 1 million years. So quite a long time. Now, obviously, this isn't the most realistic scenario. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see that more recently, Dave O'Brien has done a more thorough job using a realistic geometry, so an impact melt sheet rather than a sphere, using compositions that might be more likely to be found on Titan, including those with ammonia, and found that the timescales for these freezing timescales are somewhat shorter, on the order of 100 to 1,000 years, but still quite a long time. So if these models are correct, it seems like we have probably around 1,000 years before water in these impact melts might freeze, which is quite a long time, actually. I mean, not as long as 4.5 billion years, but enough time for chemistry to happen. So if you move to the next slide, I'm going to talk about, this is more the meat of the proposal here, is how quickly do these reactions take place? And this was the topic of my PhD thesis. So if you move along, basically what the procedure, the method I took to determine these reaction rates was, first of all, I made my own organic aerosols in the lab, and I'll talk a little bit about how I did that. These are, I'll probably be referring to them throughout the talk as tholins. Tholins is a term coined by Carl Sagan, who was one of the first to attempt to make these organic molecules. It comes from the Greek word for muddy, because they look kind of brown and goopy and muddy. So after we produce these organic molecules, we then are going to put them in water and monitor their reactions at different temperatures over time. And then finally, once we have those reaction timescales, we can compare them to the times that we just saw for which liquid water was available on Titan, about 1,000 years. So if you move to this next slide, slide 17, you'll see a schematic for how we made these organic molecules, or solens. Solens basically are just some combination of carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And really, there are hundreds of molecules that are made. And so what we did is we took 2% methane in a nitrogen atmosphere. We sparked it at low temperature and pressure and then waited. So at the diagram at lower left, you see that the gas comes in at one side, flows through this U-tube, is sparked, and over the course of several days, a film of brownish muck, which you can see on the bottom right, builds up on the sides of this tube, and then we can scrape it off and use it for further chemistry and analysis. So if you go to the next slide, slide 18, you'll see the results of what did we make in this experiment. On the x-axis is the mass of the particle, actually the mass to charge ratio. In order to analyze these, we have to either add a hydrogen or take a hydrogen away, so they're charged. And on the y-axis is the intensity, which gives you some idea of the amount of product that is there. And there are a bunch of different peaks here, as you can see, and each of these peaks represents an entirely different molecule, a different combination of carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And you'll also notice that they seem to peak every about 14 mass units. If you look at the top right, you'll see another diagram from the ion and neutral mass spectrometer on board Cassini. And you'll see actually a very similar pattern. Now, the mass ranges for these two plots are different. The instrument that I use for these measurements does not have much sensitivity below about 100 atomic mass units, whereas the ion and neutral mass spectrometer only goes up to 100 mass units. But they both show very similar patterns. These peaks every about 14 mass units, which corresponds to the mass of CH2. So it seems like perhaps the chemistry that's occurring in Titan's atmosphere is not that dissimilar to what we're producing in the laboratory. If you go to the next slide, slide 19, just a brief overview of our experimental method. We took these polymers, these solens that we made, and we placed them in water at a range of temperatures from 0 degrees Celsius, the freezing point of water, all the way up to 40 degrees Celsius. Then we monitored them over time for about a month with very high-resolution mass spectrometry. And that's the instrument you see at bottom right. And this is really the key to the whole enterprise, is this extremely high-resolution mass spectrometry. What it does is it allows you to tell exactly which molecule you're looking at. Now, most of the time, there's some ambiguity, since CH2 has a nominal mass of 14, just like nitrogen, and CH4 has a nominal mass of 16, just like oxygen. So it's really hard to tell what it is you're making. But with this instrument, you can tell an oxygen, which has a mass of 15.9994 amu, from methane, which has a mass of 16.042 amu. So it's good enough that you can tell these slight differences in the molecules of the molecules apart and know exactly what it is you're looking at. And this allows us to monitor a whole range of different molecules that are being produced and destroyed in these reactions. So if you go to the next slide, slide 20, you'll see some of the results of this work. Again, the x-axis represents the mass-to-charge ratio. And again, each of these little peaks represents an entirely different molecule. Y-axis is the intensity, or the amount, approximately the amount of that particular molecule. This was one of the samples done at 40 degrees Celsius at 0 hours, the initial data take. On the left, the furthermost left, you'll see that I've marked our internal standard. This is a molecule that does not react with water, so we can compare the other intensities to it to see if they are growing or decaying or staying constant with time. And then in the middle of the graph, I've highlighted three species, all of which without oxygen. And I want you to keep an eye on those as we proceed to future slides. So now I'm going to flip to the slide 21, which was the same temperature after 6 hours. And you'll notice that those three species I've highlighted in the previous slide were higher than the internal standard are now about the same intensity. And then if you go to the next slide, slide 22, which is after 25 hours, you'll see that these three species are noticeably smaller than the internal standard. And so what that means is that these species are going away. They're disappearing, and that's likely because they're reacting with the water to create new products. So now we're going to zoom in to one of these peaks at 251 atomic mass units, and that's highlighted in red at the bottom right. And so if you go to the next slide, slide 23, you'll see a zoom in of that region. And each of these peaks that you see here are different molecules, and we can tell exactly which ones they are by their mass. And I've labeled two of them, one of them with oxygen on the left and one of them without oxygen on the right. And you'll notice that, and again, we're at 40 degrees Celsius at zero time, 0 hours. And you'll notice there is some oxygen even in this initial sample. And that's likely due to contamination when we're making these tholins in the lab. Some air gets into the nitrogen and methane tanks we use, or there might be a slight leak in the apparatus. It's really hard to get rid of oxygen when you're on Earth and you're surrounded by it. But so there is some small contamination, but if you go to the next slide, after 6 hours, you'll see that after reacting with water for 6 hours, this peak has jumped considerably. And after 25 hours, on the next slide, slide 25, it dominates the mass range here. So though we do have some slight contamination at the start, these molecules are obviously reacting with water quite quickly over time. And in the same vein, the non-oxygenated species, the one without oxygen in it on the right, has decreased quite a bit in intensity. So it is being used up. It's reacting with the water to produce something different. So if you go to the next slide, slide 26, you'll see all the data we collected for this one species at four different temperatures, 0 degrees Celsius at the top left and 40 degrees Celsius at the bottom right. And you'll see that all of these different peaks, over time, they are growing. So you start with some amount, and then it grows over time as it reacts with the water. And this is true for all four temperatures. This is what's known as a first-order reaction, where the reaction rate is directly proportional to the amount of the component in solution, and these are fairly common in chemistry. You'll also notice that the reaction rates increase as temperature increases, which is also expected. The more energy you have, the faster something can take place. If you go to the next slide, slide 27, you'll see that, so what I showed you was just data from one species, but we had hundreds of species, as you could see in one of the previous slides, and we can monitor all of them. And out of these, the histograms show the results of these experiments, and they show you the average half-life. The half-life is the amount of time it takes for that species to go from its initial concentration halfway up to the plateau. If you go to the previous slide, you can see what I mean by the plateau. It eventually just the intensity levels out. And these half-lives are very short. They're on the order of days. And what we saw was that the reactions, the liquid water available on Titan is present for at least 100 years. So it seems as if these reactions are much quicker than the time we would need on Titan to have these reactions take place, which is kind of exciting. If you go to the next slide, slide 28, you can see a plot which shows the four rate coefficients that I showed you previously plotted versus their temperature. And at top left is an equation that a guy named Arrhenius came up with that relates these reaction rates and their temperatures to a quantity called the activation energy, or EA. And so this allows you to take data from a few different temperatures and extrapolate it to other temperatures to determine what reaction rates you might expect to find at temperatures that are more difficult to study in the lab. For example, 176 Kelvin, which is the temperature that you might find in an ammonia-rich solution on Titan. So if you go to the next slide, slide 29, you'll see again a histogram showing the results of all the different activation energies we were able to calculate. Just in general, activation energy sort of represents the amount of energy you need to have a reaction proceed. And you'll see they all sort of hover around 60 kilojoules per mole. And so in addition to telling us sort of allowing us to extrapolate our reaction rates outside of the four temperatures that we studied, it also tells us something perhaps about the molecules that are reacting, since different types of molecules have different characteristic activation energies. And it's interesting to note that something called an aliphatic imine, which is basically a long chain of carbons doubly bonded to a nitrogen, also have a very similar activation energy. So it might be that these are quite common in the hazes we're creating in the lab, this particular type of molecule. Now, if you go to slide 30, the next slide, I've taken this equation, this Arrhenius equation that I showed you two slides previously, and I've tried to extrapolate it down to the lowest temperature we might find on Titan, 176 Kelvin. And so this is assuming that the reactions taking place near room temperature are similar to those that might take place at 176 Kelvin, which is not necessarily true, but it's a starting point. And if you use this equation with an activation energy of 60 kilojoules per mole and a reaction rate of, that on the order of a day, you'll find that these reactions would take about 6,000 years at 176 Kelvin, which is quite a long time, but not necessarily beyond the length of time you might expect to find liquid water available on Titan. So that sort of wraps up the reaction rates. I also did a similar study in ammonia water, which I'm not going to present here, and the findings were very similar, except that the reactions seemed to go a little bit quicker when you added ammonia to the mix, and they also seemed to incorporate nitrogen from the solution. So the ammonia in the water, which has nitrogen, was being the tolins were to react with that to create new species. So that's kind of interesting.
So, Catherine, maybe now would be a time to stop and take a few questions since you're kind of changing topics.
Sure, that'd be great. Does anybody have any questions?
Any questions out there for all you chemists? I'm racking my brain for all my college chemistry here, but
I'm happy to answer, you know,
simpler
questions
stuff.
Too. Yeah, basic
yeah.
stuff. I hope I haven't been too over.
No. It's just not my strong suit. But are there questions out there from the audience so far? So the reaction with ammonia, that's a more realistic kind of scenario one would think for Titan, right?
Well, it depends. We don't necessarily know what Titan's made of. Now, if you're getting a lava coming from the interior of Titan, it's likely it would contain ammonia, since in order for it to, an interior liquid layer to remain liquid, it probably needs some ammonia as an antifreeze. But if you're just melting the crust through an impact, it kind of depends what the crust is made of. And
sure.
If it's just pure water, then it might be the melting temperature might be as high as 273 Kelvin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think there's a broad range of what we might expect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Any questions out there?
I've got one.
Go ahead.
My name is Tish Brzee from Copernic Observatory in Vestal, New York.
Why don't you spell it, because we've had some issues with names.
Okay, T-I-S-H is my first name.
Mm-hmm.
Brzee, B-R-E-S-E-E.
Great. Go ahead. Thanks.
Okay, the question is on slide 10, the cold origin of life. You've got evidence of a faint sun on Earth. Can you tell us where you got that information?
I think this comes from the astronomers. In the early days, the sun was fainter. In its early lifetime, and this is actually it causes another question to be raised, namely, how was there ever liquid water on Earth 4 billion years ago? Wasn't it too cold? And so people invoke large atmospheres with carbon dioxide and so forth to warm up the planet, but I'm pretty sure that solar models of the sun predict it to be about 33% fainter in its early life, and it's been increasing in intensity since then.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, go ahead, Catherine.
I have, yeah, This is Lynn. You now know my name from the email. I was wondering if there's any sort of tectonics on, I've forgotten, on Titan that might also contribute to the warm.
What do you mean by tectonics contributing to the warmth?
Well, in any sort of internal activity in the core of Titan that would also contribute to the temperature at low.
Well, right. So most of the energy at Titan is probably coming from inside of its from its interior.
Titan. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, it's too far from Saturn for tides to really be that important. Or that's what the thinking is. So most of the energy that drives Titan comes from radioactive elements in its interior. And this might be what any volcanism, any tectonics that we'd see on Titan would be driven by this radioactive energy coming from the interior of Titan. So tectonics might be indicative of an active Titan, but it's probably unlikely that you'd find liquid water in a tectonically active region, unless there's volcanism nearby as well. If volcanism exists on Titan, which is again another open question. There are some people who think Titan is basically Callisto with an atmosphere. Callisto being the second largest moon of Jupiter, which looks like a fairly dead world. But I think Titan is a little bit more active than Callisto, even though they might be about the same size and have a similar interior structure. So.
Okay.
But these are all open questions, yeah.
Okay, great. Any other questions while we're paused? Okay. Go ahead, Catherine.
Okay. So if you want to go to slide 31, I'm going to go into talking about sort of what the nature of the products that we're making is, and if they look anything like the biological molecules we might find on Earth or the early Earth. So if you go to the next slide, slide 32, basically the question is, okay, that's great. So you monitored these reactions, and there was oxygen included, but was there anything biologically relevant formed in these experiments? And so I wanted to dig a little deeper into the structure of the products. Now, some previous workers have looked at this. Bishan Kare was one of the first to do this, created solens in his lab, and then basically boiled them in acid for about a day, which isn't a terribly realistic scenario for Titan, but he did produce several amino acids, including the simplest amino acids, glycine, alanine, and aspartic acid, as well as urea. More recently, Francois Roland has hydrolyzed these solens in a more neutral pH. But again, he did so at relatively high temperature, 70 degrees Celsius, for a short time scale. And he produced many of the same biological molecules that Kare did. So I wanted to try something a little bit more realistic. So taking these haze analogs and reacting them with water at lower temperature from about 253 Kelvin to room temperature, 293 Kelvin. You'll notice that 253 Kelvin is below the normal freezing point of water. That's because I added some amount of ammonia to this solution. So it's an ammonia water solution, and the ammonia is acting as an antifreeze. And then we left this to react for about a year. This is basically the leftovers from the ammonia experiment I did after the water experiment. And we just picked up where we left off after a year. Now, what we did, if you go to the next slide, slide 33, is we then searched through all the species that were created in a year in these solutions to see if any of the masses corresponded to the masses we might find, expect for an amino acid or a nucleobase. A nucleobase is one of the components of DNA and RNA, our genetic material. So we wanted to see if we could find any of these simple molecules in that had the same mass as those we were finding in our hydrolyzed solen sample. And actually, we did. We found almost all of the amino acids and nucleobases you might expect to find. Unfortunately, the mass is not alone is not enough to make an identification for different species. When you have several different carbons and a bunch of hydrogen, a couple of nitrogens, you can arrange them in many different structures, and only one of those is consistent with the biological molecule you're interested in. So what we really need to do is then focus on these particular molecules and trying to figure out what the structure of these molecules is. And to do that, we fragmented them. So we took the molecule of interest and we bombarded it either with a neutral molecule that's known as quadrupole collision-induced dissociation, or we shot them with a laser beam, with an IR laser beam. And both of these will cause the original molecule to break up into smaller pieces. And then we can compare the pieces that came off of our species with a pure sample of the original biomolecule to see if there were similarities or differences. So if you go to the next slide, slide 34, it shows a diagram of the six species that we focused on. And these were six species that had large enough intensity that we could hope to see products when we fragmented them. And these included five amino acids, asparagine, aspartic acid, glutamine, glutamic acid, and histidine, as well as one nucleobase, thymine. And I'm going to show you two examples. The first one is an example where we think we have identified the species, and the second is an example where I think we have not identified the species. And those of you looking at the PDF, this is where some of the graphs get a little goofy, so I would recommend looking at the PowerPoint. So if you go to the next slide, slide 35, there is a spectra of aspartic acid. And so what you see on the x-axis is the mass-to-charge ratio, as you're familiar with previously in the talk. And so these identify different molecules. On the right here is the parent molecule, C4H6NO4. And then to the left are all of the species that are formed after you fragment it. So you'll see a species consistent with the loss of ammonia, a species consistent with the loss of water, a species consistent with the loss of carbon dioxide, and so forth. And up top, we have the pure standard. So this was just a sample of aspartic acid that we bought from a store. And on the bottom is our tholin sample, which we had left in water at room temperature for a year. You'll also notice there's a lot of peaks with stars on them. Those are noise, so you can ignore those. But if you compare the two, the pure sample at top to the tholin sample on the bottom, you'll see that there are a lot of similarities. They both have ammonia and water loss, hydrogen peroxide loss, carbon dioxide loss, and so forth. So these two fragmentation spectra look very similar, which means that probably the structure of the molecule we have in our tholin sample is very similar to that of aspartic acid. If you go to the next slide, slide 36, I'm just going to zoom in on that red box to show you just how good the overlap is. So up top is the loss of carbon dioxide from our pure aspartic acid sample, and down at the bottom is a similar loss from our tholin sample. And you see they have exactly the same mass. And that mass is exactly what you'd expect if aspartic acid were to lose carbon dioxide. And this is expected from a structure like aspartic acid by losing one of these, it's called a carbonyl group, COOH. You'd expect to see a carbon dioxide come off. So this is very expected, and so it seems very consistent with the presence of aspartic acid in our tholin sample. So if you go to the next slide, slide 37, you'll see what I think is a negative example, and that is for the molecule histidine, another amino acid. Up top, again, we have our pure standard of histidine, and on the bottom is our tholin sample. Again, I've highlighted those peaks that are consistent with losses of various molecules like water and ammonia. And if you compare the two, the pure standard up top to the tholin standard sample at the bottom, you notice that they don't look very similar. There are many losses from the pure histidine sample that you don't see in the tholin sample. There is a small water peak, but it's not very intense. There's also, to the left, you can see there's a loss of this strange nitrile. A nitrile is when you have nitrogen triply bonded to a carbon, which you don't see in the histidine standard. So the sample that we have in our, the species that we have in our tholin sample, if there is a structure similar to histidine in there, it's definitely not the dominant structure. And so it's unlikely that we actually have histidine in our sample. If you go to the next slide, slide 38, we can zoom in just to show you that the species you might expect, like this double water loss here, is not present in our solen sample at the bottom. And you'd expect a double water loss from a species like histidine by losing some of these oxygens off the side here. So if you go to slide 39, I'm going to summarize the findings. Although I wasn't able to show you all of the spectra that we obtained, I can tell you that, like aspartic acid, we have good evidence for the amino acids asparagine, glutamine, and glutamic acid in our solen sample. We don't, as I just mentioned, we don't have any good evidence for histidine. As for our one nucleobase, thymine, unfortunately, it turns out it doesn't fragment. We tried hitting it with different energies, but it just wouldn't break apart. And so it's hard to compare your standard, which has no fragments, to a sample. So unfortunately, we don't know if thymine is present because we weren't able to fragment it. But we do have good evidence for these four amino acids. And it's actually interesting to note that they all look kind of similar. They all have very similar structures. You have this carbonyl group, the COOH group, on the side here, and with carbon chains, all being very similar in structure. So maybe the chemistry on Titan might favor these sorts of molecules. So finally, if you move to slide 40, I'm going to give you a sneak peek at some of the topics I'm interested in pursuing in the future, although I'd be happy to take any questions on the topic I just spoke about, if you have any.
Sounds like maybe not.
Okay. Then I'll continue.
Great.
If you go to slide 41, I'll introduce it. Now, basically, the idea is, okay, it looks like we might be forming amino acids and other biological molecules on Titan, but can we see them? Can we see them with Cassini-Huygens data? Since it seems unlikely that we'll get back to Titan with a new spacecraft anytime soon, unfortunately, we have to see whether or not we can challenge any of these hypotheses with the data we currently have. And two areas I want to focus on that seem particularly interesting for this topic are two areas called Tui and Hotei Regio. And what you see here at the bottom is a map of Titan taken by the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, or VIMS. And the different colors here represent different wavelengths. The orange one represents 5 microns. And you'll see that other than a few bright spots, these are clouds near the poles, there's really only two areas that are bright at five micron, really bright at 5 micron, and those are Tui and Hotei Regio. At top right, you'll see a higher resolution view of Hotei Regio, and it looks actually vaguely volcanic in nature. You see flows and pits and lobate sort of regions here, which all would be consistent with a large volcanic region. We also have radar data over this region, and it also looks very similar. We don't, unfortunately, have any good high-resolution views over Tui Regio yet, but that would be another interesting place to look. But if these regions are cryovolcanically active, they might be a region you might look for biological molecules, since there is liquid water there that can react with the organic molecules coming from Titan's atmosphere. To go to the next slide, slide 42, you'll also notice that there's been one of the very few spectral features we have seen on Titan was observed at Tui Regio, and the graph at bottom left shows you that feature. It's this slight dip, which I've indicated with a red arrow. And really, this is, as I said, one of the very few features that has been detected on Titan's surface. And as far as I'm concerned, there hasn't really been a good identification of this feature. Tom McCord suggested that it was carbon dioxide, and you can see the carbon dioxide spectra just below the Titan spectra of Tui Regio. And you'll see that it doesn't really line up. I'm not a fan of carbon dioxide simply because it doesn't seem to line up with the species that we're seeing. Roger Clark, another scientist, has argued that it perhaps is acetonitrile, which is a molecule you might expect to be made in Titan's atmosphere, and in fact it's been observed. But what would concentrate acetonitrile in just these two areas and nowhere else, I'm not really sure. So the geologic context of having acetonitrile concentrated in two areas on Titan, again, I'm not really sure if that's plausible. So I'm proposing that perhaps it might be caused by the presence of biological molecules. And this is work I'm just sort of thinking through. I haven't done a lot of work, so I can't say for sure whether this is true, but it's something I thought it was interesting to think about. So if you go to the next slide, slide 43, what we're proposing to do is to take spectra of biomolecules in this wavelength range. It turns out that most reflectance spectrum, that is spectrum that where you look at the reflectance of the molecule, which is how VIMS takes its data, so they're comparable that way. Most of it only goes out to about 2.5 microns, whereas this feature is at near 5 microns, and the gray boxes you see in this plot here on this slide show you the windows through Titan's atmosphere, those windows which you can see through the haze and the methane to the surface. And most of these are also further than 2.5 microns. So what I'd really like to do is take spectra of some of these biological tools to see if they're similar to what we're seeing at Hotei and Tui Regio. What we have here is a spectrum taken of glycine, which is the simplest amino acid. The green line is data I collected from the USDA. They actually have taken data for a number of different molecules, including grains and chickpeas and Captain Crunch. They have quite the list. It's very interesting to look through. And then I've overplotted on that. The black line is data we took here at APL, where I work, of a dry sample of glycine. And then up top, the red line is glycine that was placed in water and then under vacuum, frozen, and then under vacuum desiccated. And you'll notice that all the spectrum is a little bit different than the dry glycine spectrum. And unfortunately, neither of them show a large absorption band near 4.9 microns, like the one we see in Tui Regio. But if you go to the next slide, slide 44, you'll notice that if you just look at those four bands where you're seeing the surface of Titan, that this desiccated glycine spectrum looks kind of similar to what we see at Tui Regio. So what you're seeing here is the blue line is ice, the spectrum for ice, which has quite a high intensity at 2.7 microns compared to 2.8, whereas Tui Regio, this odd bright spot on Titan, is the opposite. It has higher intensity at 2.8 microns than 2.7. And this actually looks fairly similar to the desiccated glycine sample that I took. Now, of course, we can't make any definite identifications just yet, but it is sort of intriguing and something I'm planning to pursue more, trying to figure out what it is that makes these unusual areas on Titan. So just to wrap up, basically what I presented here, that it turns out that when you react the organics in Titan's atmosphere with liquid water in transient liquid water environments on the surface, you can get reactions that are very fast, on the order of days, which is much faster than you'd expect any liquid water to be available on Titan's surface. And that when you look at the structure of these molecules, they look they are very consistent with at least four amino acids that we identified in a Tholen sample that had been placed in ammonia water for a year. So finally, on the last slide, I just want to argue that if we ever do have the chance to go back to Titan, that I think both impact craters and cryovolcanic flows would be a very interesting place to look, because if there is biological molecules there, this might be one of the best places in the solar system to look and to teach us something about how life formed on our own world. So thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to take any questions now.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Are there questions in the audience for our speaker?
Maybe I could have a try at my earlier question again, because I don't think I stated it very clearly. What I was getting at is this was, by the way, very, very interesting. And we were talking about what's happening on Titan today, and my question was more oriented about the past, but would there be a chance because of the radioactivity or in earlier times in Titan that there would have been water for a much longer time, or maybe water under the surface, where there would be a much better chance of those biomolecules having a longer time to have been formed?
Right. Yeah, that is a good question. Sorry, I didn't understand it the first time. Actually, it's likely that Titan's surface was actually liquid water for the first, I think, about 100 million years before, just from the heat of formation of the planet, before it froze, it likely had about 100 million years of liquid water at the surface. Now, if Titan has subsequently froze, and if that water is still around, it would be under the surface now. And it looks like Titan likely does have a subsurface ocean. There's been some evidence that that Titan does have an ocean under its icy shell. But any organic molecules you might get would have had to have been deposited very early in the solar system during those 100 million years when the surface of Titan was still liquid. Since then, the surface is frozen, and it's probably about, on the order of 100 kilometers thick. So you're not going to get anything down there these days. But if you had enough carbon deposited through comets or little chunks of the leftovers of the solar system formation, it's possible you could have something going on down there. And there's a nice little paper written about 10 years ago, which determined whether or not the conditions in a subsurface ocean on Titan were amenable to life as we know it on Earth, and it turns out it probably is. But most of the life, most of the organic molecules were formed after that point, and so Titan is now coated in this organic goop, and that, unfortunately, probably never made it down to the ocean. So kind of we have two separate areas on Titan for looking for prebiotic or biotic chemistry.
Good, thank you. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it also turns out that, as I mentioned, the sun is going to proceed towards red giant phase and boil the Earth and actually engulf the Earth. At that point, it might actually be a good time for Titan, where the crust would again melt, and you'd have all these organic molecules with liquid water. And who knows, there might be a brief period of life on Titan before the sun explodes. Well, not explodes, but, dies.
Interesting. Any other questions? So can you think, Catherine, of additional observations that would resolve some of these questions? You were talking about the VIM spectra. We just were approved for a 7-year XXM. And are there additional observations that you can think of that we haven't yet made? More
higher resolution data over TUI Regio would be nice. But unfortunately, Cassini was never really equipped to answer these sorts of questions. You really need a surface lander with a very high resolution mass spectrometer or some other instrument that could identify biological molecules.
Mm-hmm.
So, ideally, I'd like to send my,
mass
spectrometer, but fortunately, it probably weighs about a ton, and it's about the size of a car.
Yeah, not likely.
I think people are working on miniaturizing instruments like that, though, so mm-hmm. you could send them. But at the moment, I think VIMS is our best bet, and unfortunately, it's limited in certain ways, namely
right.
by the atmosphere. So.
Sure. So, I heard your comments about getting the glycine spectra from the FDA. That's a curious thing. So they take
the USDA.
USDA, mm-hmm. sorry. So they take spectra of these different foodstuffs and molecules. And
There's papers on trying to figure out which amino acids are in rice, and they do that using spectra. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I would never have guessed.
Yeah.
Just a quick question. This is Gordon Houston, Houston, Texas. What instruments would you use to inspect the impact craters or the chiral volcanic flows? What instrument package would you like to see investigate them?
Well, right. So, again, having a really high-resolution mass spectrometer would be pretty great in my mind. You'd need some way, though, to sample the surface, too. Although it seems likely that any probe we sent to Titan would likely be airborne, because that's probably the easiest way to get around. And there was one paper where they looked at how solens might fluoresce under certain conditions. So if you get really close to the ground and hit it with a certain wavelength of light, you could see whether or not it fluoresced to tell whether or not there are solens that have reacted with water there. So that might be an easier way to go about it rather than sending a big mass spectrometer. I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question.
All right, thanks.
Any other questions? I noticed that Titan, I think it's Astrobiology Magazine, did a public opinion survey about what bodies we should go to for the future missions, although that's been decided certainly for the next flagship mission. But sad to say, Titan was down on the list. Are you familiar with this?
No. What ranking was it?
It was well below Europa and all the Jupiter system sort of won out. Maybe that's just because that's what we're planning to do. But Titan was at the bottom of the pack.
I'm afraid. See, the thing about Europa, I think people want to find fish in Europa.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're never going to find fish in our lifetime, even if they're there. It's very complicated to get under a 10-kilometer thick layer of ice.
Mm-hmm.
And my question, the problem with Europa is that where's the carbon?
Right.
So it might have a lot of water, but water is not enough for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's great about Titan is it's covered in both carbon and water. So you have all the ingredients you might need. I think the reason maybe Titan would fall further on that list is because you're not going to find fish, necessarily. That's what people want to see. What you'd find are these building blocks of life, not necessarily life itself.
Yeah.
But I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to talk about more about these processes, and people might find them more interesting at that point.
Yeah, it did strike me as odd, given all the interesting chemistry that could go on. But so be it. So any other final questions for our speaker? So that was a great talk, Catherine. I really appreciate you participating in the CHARM telecon. It was really enjoyable. So we'll get everything posted and tidied up, and it'll be posted on the website within a few days. And thanks again. For those in the audience, we have another talk on Titan. There was a recent article published in Scientific American. It was Ralph Lorenz and Christophe Sautin. And Christophe is going to join us. I think the title of the article was Titan, the Moon That Would Be a Planet, or something like that. So if you want to read that article in advance of next month's CHARM, I certainly intend to do that. And so I look forward to that. So a couple of good Titan talks right in a row.
What magazine was that?
It's Scientific American.
Thank you.
Sure.
And who's the author?
The first, I think it was Lorenz, Lorenz, and Sautin, Sotin. So Christophe Sautin will be our speaker.
Is that an March 2010 Scientific American?
Say again?
Please, is that a March 2000?
Oh, the month, I'm not certain, but it did just come out, so I would say either February or March.
Okay. And check it out.
Yeah, great.
Thank you so much for the talk. Very complex. Even my organic chemistry is good. It was pretty complex.
Yeah, it's interesting though. Thank you very much. And thank you, Catherine. And we'll talk to you all next month.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.